The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly, the last four of the Women's World Cup, and it's the glorious, humble, total football playing English against the fouling, over-celebrating, spying Americans to see who beats Sweden or the Netherlands in the final. We'll look back at the quarters and look ahead to the semis. Elsewhere, virtually no goals in the Copa America as Luis Suarez burst into tears. At AFCON, Madagascar spring the surprise of the tournament by beating one of the favourites, while Haiti do the same in the Gold Cup. Back home, Spurs might have bought two players by the time you hear this. We'll do some mindless transfer gossip, all that, plus baby shout-outs, your questions, and Wayne Rooney from the halfway line. And that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. Question from Jordan. How does Barry plan to execute, quote, Operation Lose Three Stone?
Yeah, this is a worry. I mentioned on Twitter that I plan to lose three stone, and it got such an overwhelming tidal wave of responses that I promptly deleted it.
Did you actually delete it?
But yeah, I'm Operation Lose Three. I'd say if I cut down on beer, mm-hmm. I'd probably lose three stone quite quickly.
Excellent. Before the pod, Lars Iverson, you said you'd join Barry in some sort of Guardian pod competition.
I just think in terms of motivation, if you make it not a proper competition, because that's naff, but just slightly competitive. So if you're sat on your ass, you can think, like, I've got to get up now because somewhere out there, Glenn Denning is exercising.
There's probably a very good chance he won't be.
Well, but I won't know that. I'll be sat in the other end of London thinking, you know, Glenn Denning.
Like, if you lost three stone, would you admit what your age is? Because still many people
but it's
desperate
not like
to know.
It's out there. Like all the Norwegians explained it after the last time we did this.
I mean, explaining someone's age is that's a quite grand
term. I just enjoy withholding information from you, Max.
It's fine. I must admit, it does not keep me awake at night.
It does seem like it triggers something in you anyway.
Hey, Tim Stillman, how are you?
Yeah, not too bad, thank you.
Is this your third appearance in as many weeks?
Indeed, becoming a regular.
You are. I mean, I guess if you didn't become a regular as a women's football and South American football expert while the Women's World Cup and Copa America is on, you were never going to become one, I suppose.
No. I'm in that happy window every 4 years where the Copa America and Women's World Cup happen at the same time, and I start keeping very unregular hours.
And you get to come in and cover our many, many shortcomings.
Right. Let's start then with the quarterfinals. England 3, Norway 0. Jill Scott, Ellen White, Lucy Bronze with the goals. Their best performance of the tournament, Baz?
I think so, without question. Very, very impressive. I would temper that slightly by saying I expected more from Norway. I thought they were pretty poor, but that is probably a good reflection on England's dominance. My only concern would be, not for the first time or the second in this tournament, England sort of went to sleep, switched off for 10 minutes in the second half, around the 70-minute mark. And in that time, Norway had three excellent scoring chances, all of which they failed to convert. So that is a concern for England, but otherwise, absolutely outstanding performance.
Lars, Eric the Red, Henrik Ibsen, Edvard Grieg, Jens Stoltenberg, Roald Dahl, was he one of yours? Anyway, your boys took one hell of a beating.
Yeah, they did. I think there were two things that went wrong in particular for Norway. I think our left back, Christina Minde, God bless her, she's not a bad player, but she's not a defender. She plays in a further advanced position for a club team. And so her defending on the left against England's sort of right flank of doom with Lucy Bronze and Nikita Paris, that was always going to be a terrible matchup. I think we spoke about it last weekend, actually. And that's something that worried me going into the game. And you saw both goals came down the flank there in the first half. And we were also just the extent to which we were outplayed in the middle of the pitch was a problem, because that meant Caroline Graham Hansen, our best player, started dropping deep to get involved with play, which is fine. But when she did that, once we did get the ball and tried to attack quickly, it left our other striker, Harlofsen, very isolated. So tactically, it wasn't working in our favour. And also just a lot of otherwise good players and our big players maybe didn't have their best game. I mean, just little decisions that were not right, first touches that weren't quite there, passes that weren't quite as accurate as they could be. So I think a few of them on an individual level will be left feeling that they could have done better, which is frustrating.
I wonder, Tim, if it's obviously tournament football, the games come thick and fast, and fitness and tiredness is a big thing. And I wonder, I tend to see more of a sort of wider gap between teams in this World Cup than I would in the men's World Cup.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is quite a big advantage England have got at the moment. For example, when they play USA, for many, many years, USA had this huge physical edge over everyone. I don't think they're going to have that against England. The Norwegian coach has been criticised, actually, in the build-up to this game for not using substitutions properly, for not rotating the team. And I think that really kind of caught up with them in this game. But I think this was possibly England's best game under Phil Neville. What I really liked was that even at 2-0, he was making attacking substitutions. He obviously saw some frailty in Norway and he kept going for it instead of kind of sitting back. And I thought England were as impressive as Norway were unimpressive. Mm.
Lucy Bronze was just a cut above, wasn't she? She's a different level for me from pretty much... I mean, there are a few... other players in the tournament, but she's so good.
Well, Phil Neville insists that she's the best player in the world at the moment, and I don't think he's just saying that just to massage her ego, because her performances have been outstanding. They were outstanding in this game. The goal she scored was an absolute beauty, but again, Norway sort of gifted it to her because they had been warned. She had been left unmarked at least one, if not two, set pieces before she was left unmarked again to score that wonderful screamer from, you know, surface-to-air missile into the back of the net. She is outstanding. But, I mean, there were a lot of good performances. And I don't know if Tim's talking about the Norwegian coach's reluctance to use substitutions. If that shows he doesn't trust his substitutes and doesn't have enough strength and depth. But, you know, the three Phil Neville made, Rachel Daly, Georgia Stanway and Beth Mead, and Daly and Mead in particular, were all excellent, you know, when they came on too.
I do think you mentioned England falling asleep, and we also, the other thing that happened was that we threw on Lisa Marie Utland as we had another striker up front, her of the frankly magnificent ponytail, we have to be the fabulous stuff, very majestic, and once she came on I thought we had more physical presence up front and we were able to trouble England a little bit more. And that's another thing that was frustrating, because in those moments we saw that England could be got at, even though England were the best team by a significant margin, that leaves this a bit frustrating coming away from the game.
Steph Horton made some incredible last ditch tackles. Did we worry at all about how last ditch they were?
Yeah, I definitely do, actually. I still think that England are slightly weak, maybe in defence. I think Millie Bright had an excellent first half of the season with Chelsea, but the second half she dropped off maybe a little bit. She was carrying a bit of a knee injury, and Steph did a lot of kind of mopping up after her. I think that the US, particularly with that front three they've got, I think they'll be looking at that against England. And as Barry said, with the kind of tendency to fall asleep, if they fall asleep for 10 minutes against the US, then the game's going to be put out of their reach.
Millie Bright, during that 10 minutes, arguably had the worst 5 minutes I've ever seen anyone have in a football match. She got away with it. Now, I don't know if that's a characteristic of hers, or if, you know, she perhaps hadn't fully recovered from that illness, or, you know, and wasn't fully fit. We'll say, hopefully, that was the case. But some of her errors were bordering on calamitous, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. I just wanted to go back to Lucy Bronze, actually, because I think she's really going to hold the key to this USA game. I've got a hunch that Phil Neville's going to change things and put her in midfield. This is something he tried in the build-up to the tournament. Yeah. So Rachel Daly, she can play everywhere. She plays up front for her club, but she can play on the wing and she can play at right back. The last time England played the US in March, Rachel Daly played at right back. Because the US used this 4-3-3 and they've got a brilliant midfield, like a perfectly balanced midfield three, and England have been using a 4-2-3-1. I think that he's going to take Fran Kirby out, put that extra space in midfield, and I think Lucy Bronze will play in midfield and Phil Neville will look to match USA up. And that shows what a great player she is, that, you know, he can just take her out of her natural position and right back and put her in midfield.
That's a risk, though, isn't it? I mean, if it goes wrong, it's a risk, but I guess...
It is, and I would also think, I mean, Tim, you know more about this than I do, but Crystal Dunn playing left-back for the US is a bit of a utility player as well, probably better going forward than she is defending, am I right in saying?
Yeah, she's not really a left-back.
Yeah, so with England's right flank of doom having already destroyed Norway just by being really having a really good matchup there, when you're facing a similar situation, why would you change it?
I think that Lucy Bronze would probably play on the right of that midfield three, so she could still go over there. The thing I'd say about Crystal Dunn, she has been identified as a potential weak point for the US, but she played up against Diani for France in the quarterfinal, and everyone thought, myself included, that this would cause real trouble, and actually she handled her brilliantly, so maybe she's not quite the weak spot that we thought.
Nikita Paris missed another penalty. Should she stop taking them?
Maybe, yes. I think England have got a few other players who can take them. You look at the way Steph Horton takes free kicks, for example. I think she'd be a great penalty taker myself.
Or Ellen White, presumably. Yeah. I mean,
and it was a good save. It was a save within the new law. You know, the VAR could not fault it. And it's the second penalty save for Inge Hjemseth, who's bowing out now at 39. For the last 21 years, she's got up early before work to go to the gym, gone to work as a software engineer all day, and then going to train for the club side after the game before coming back home. That's been her life for the last 20 years. And going out with a penalty save in a World Cup quarterfinal is not a bad way to go.
And 20 years of getting up and going to the gym before work is a good way of losing 3 stone. That win for England means that Great Britain will be in the Olympics in 2020. Phil Neville says it'll be England led by me and my coaching staff. We have a fantastic pool of players to pick from, not just the ones I manage here, but Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland too. Only 12 teams in the Olympic. Tim, what's more important, the World Cup or the Olympics in women's football?
Probably the World Cup. But the Olympics is obviously a massive source of pride, not least because I think it is significant that it's something that basically the women's team do that the men's team aren't going to do as well. So it's kind of their own space as well. But obviously, like, the chance to get an Olympic medal for, you know, for lots of players who'd have come into the game as semi-professional athletes, you know, for a lot of them, this just wouldn't have figured in their thinking when they started kind of kicking a ball around. They might have thought of World Cups, but the Olympics is something a bit more unique, I think.
Am I right in thinking that in 2012, when Team GB had a football team in, that the Scots were... Did they conscientiously object, or were they just non-picked?
So one was picked, Kim Little, who plays for Arsenal, and she would probably be picked again because she would...
Sorry, I was actually talking about the men's team, but carry on.
But yeah, kind of the same deal. Kim Little kind of went into it, and she was the... I think she was the only non-English player in the women's team GB squad, and it was the same kind of conflict, yes.
And would that be... Obviously, we don't know what's going to happen in the next year, but it would be Kim Little and maybe Erin Cuthbert, and that would be it?
Yeah, maybe. Scotland have got quite a few good players, actually. Lisa Evans also plays for Arsenal. Jen Beattie plays for Arsenal as well. They've got a lot of quite good players, Scotland, who could trouble it. Wales have got Jess Fishlock, who plays for Lyon. I think she might have retired from international football now, but she might consider coming out, but... Other than that, I think it will be largely dominated by England.
Without wanting to wade into a delicate situation here, who decides that this is like England plus whichever players they want from the other countries in Great Britain? I mean, why is that the default setting here?
Well, England are the best and we'll, you know, get our country back.
Maybe there's a good reason that I just don't know. Please educate me.
I don't know either, but... I think England are a bit more prepared for this because they didn't enter a team at Rio in 2016. They could have, and it's basically because they didn't get...
But so if the Welsh had said, we're really well prepared for this, we should be taking the front seat, that would have been the way it would have gone?
I don't know, but Phil Neville was very bullish very quickly about the fact that he was going to be managing the team, so it's obviously something they've been thinking about.
I'm fairly sure that in Rio, the England women's rugby sevens team, who... they were basically taken from the England rugby team and trained professionally, more or less, as sevens players for that tournament, and then completely disgraced themselves by losing against Canada in the bronze medal match.
Lars, you would go for a combined Scandinavian team in the Olympics. I mean, you're all sort of the same, aren't you?
No, not at all, Max.
Right.
But no, I'm sure there's a perfectly logical and reason why it is that way. It just struck me as slightly odd and like comes across as a little bit presumptuous, but maybe there's a good formal agreement there.
I would think if you asked the Scottish, the Welsh and the Northern Irish if the English were presumptuous about their position in this grand union, I suspect they would all say the English are. But, you know, that's another podcast somewhere else. USA 2, France 1. So England will play the USA. Was this the game of the tournament, Tim?
I think probably in terms of quality and intensity, yes. I'm not sure it's the most entertaining. I think maybe England-Cameroon, for reasons maybe other than football, was quite entertaining.
Was it not the most entertaining because of how the US approaches, score early and then defend?
A little bit. And because they're such high-quality sides, they not cancelled each other out, I wouldn't say. But I think like the intensity of the game and the quality of the players really shone through. And actually, I think both teams played quite well. It's just USA got that early goal and that enabled them to play in such a way that they kind of kept France at arm's length.
If there is a star of the tournament currently, it is Megan Rapinoe. She's very entertaining on and off the pitch, isn't she?
Yeah, absolutely. And she always has been. She's always been very outspoken. But she's really stepped up as well because Alex Morgan has kind of been playing with a bit of an injury, I think, and not playing that well. But Megan Rapinoe's really kind of picked up the baton there.
I must confess, I didn't know much about her before this tournament, but she's great value for money on and off the pitch. And I loved the fact that she managed to enrage Donald Trump, the president of the USA, who presumably now will be absolutely sick if the States win the tournament. I would like to see England win, but I would also be pleased enough if the USA won just to see the reaction from him.
Yeah, this is the thing, like, as a neutral here, Team USA might not be the most instinctively sympathetic of the teams that you watch, but just Rapinoe sort of getting under the skins of sort of various man babies everywhere has made the whole thing much more exciting, and I feel more positive about the prospect of them winning the whole thing now.
Did anyone see that there was a headline, I can't remember which publication it was, but someone went with purple-haired lesbian goddess flattens France like a crepe.
The US appears to be the fittest and the strongest. Are they the most talented, Tim?
I think so, just about, yeah. They don't quite enjoy the dominance they used to, but I think so. I think we had a question for the pod, actually. Someone said, would the USA beat Lyon? Which is a really, really fascinating question, because Lyon basically is France, but you add Ada Hegerberg, Jennifer Morjan, Nikita Paris. I think that's a match I'd really like to see. That's really got me thinking, actually.
Can we organise it?
just the last word on France. I mean, I remember our dear friend Philippe Auclair compared Corinne Diac with Didier Deschamps, and just watching this game, that really fell into place for me, because, I mean, the French team that won the World Cup last summer, in my opinion, won it on the back of just messing up less than anyone else. Like, defensively, they were solid in a tournament where not many teams were, and they had individuals who could win them the game going forward. And this French team looked a lot the same so far, except in this game, they did mess up defensively, and the individuals up front just didn't do it. And beyond that, from a coaching perspective, what you want is for there to be a plan, a pattern, something that the coach is adding to the mix, and it didn't seem to be there, really.
Okay, then, Laws, there was a handball that I was utterly convinced would go to VAR and be a penalty, and I'd be really enraged about it. And I ended up being really enraged that a penalty I didn't want to be given wasn't given.
Yeah, I mean, people just want to be angry about VAR at this point, don't they? No, the arm was straight down by the side. It wasn't a penalty.
Is it that simple?
I mean, yeah, because when people say, oh, why didn't it go to VAR? I mean, they all go to VAR in the sense that people...
I naively did that because I think Jonathan Pearce said it hasn't gone to VAR. Or the
but it has, because they check it all the time. Yeah, they watch everything. If they think the ref, you might want to have a look at this, then they have a word in her ear. But it's not like, where is VAR? Like, it's there all the time. You just need to read the rules and not be such an idiot.
Okay. I mean, I suppose...
not you specifically.
No, absolutely acceptable.
It's like, the great frustration is that there are so many things that are annoying and bad about VAR, the way it's worked this tournament. So I get very cross when we additionally can get annoyed about stuff that's actually not to do with VAR.
Okay. Now, the US ops team, which makes them sound a bit more like the FBI than I ever thought they would be, have been looking at the hotel England are playing in. They turned up conflicting reports about whether they were wearing US tracksuits or not. And they went to look at the hotel to see what it's like, because they might have to stay there. The FA apparently are furious. Phil Neville played it down a little bit, but he said, well, we obviously wouldn't do anything like
what they wouldn't like prepare.
What an outrage, Barry.
It's a hotel. People are allowed to go in and look around. Particularly if they think they might need to book it at some point in the coming days. If the FA are outraged about it, which I find difficult to believe, then the FA really should calm down and get over it, because it's a bit of a nonsense.
First of all, I'd say it's the ultimate power move that I have a lot of respect for. But you're right, it's about being prepared, and the USA are super prepared about this kind of thing. I think where a little bit of bone of contention might be is that the USA went there when England weren't there. And there was some suggestion that, you know, they went into team meeting areas and things like that.
For God's sake.
You know, at which point you ask, well, were you leaving, like, the formation and, like, the starting lineup lying around for them to see?
Jill Ellis was asked if she was English or not in the press conference. And she gave quite a nice answer about growing up and being a Manchester United fan. But she did make sure she said the words backyard, soccer, uniform. I was looking for PKs, bologna, cherry pie by the end of it. She's in an interesting position, isn't she?
I mean, I'm not really one to talk about like accents and the way you talk about things and your nationality. I'm just going to swerve that in that issue completely.
Absolutely. How do we see the game going, Tim?
So
is it America's to lose?
I think just about. I mean, don't be absolutely shocked if England pull this off. I don't think there's an awful lot between the two teams, but I think the thing with the USA, they're probably slightly more quality than England, but I think they've just got that kind of, they know how to get it done. That kind of extra bit of nous, and I think that might just win them the game in the end.
Lars, you've broken your microphone. What for?
I don't know. It came apart.
Were you meddling with it?
I wasn't.
Okay.
Now, before we leave this, I wasn't as annoyed as some were by Phil Neville sort of appointing himself arbiter of what's good and right in the game after the Cameroon game. I thought the Cameroonian conduct was disgraceful and wasn't wrong for him to call it out. But I did think Phil Neville, with Hotel Spygate going, oh, yeah, it's not something I would have my team ever do. It was like, you wouldn't have your logistics people check out a hotel that you might have to stay in if someone else happened to be staying in that hotel. I think that's really weird. Well, I genuinely don't see the problem with it. It's so odd, and I don't understand why. It's a bit childish to get you know, to spend that much energy on it, I think.
Well, I presume he was asked about it, so.
Well, you could say.
I wouldn't imagine he.
Whatever, they'll probably be staying. I mean, this is.
Didn't England share a hotel with Cameroon as well? I mean, it's ridiculous, but anyway.
Anyway,
we've learned a lot about this tournament, about what Phil Neville is okay with and what he isn't okay with. And
that's good to know if we ever go away with him.
Yeah.
It's good to know,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Very useful.
Do you give England what's your percentage chances for England, America, and the US, do you reckon, Baz?
I think the US, on the evidence of what I've seen, are a better team. I think if England can keep their focus for the whole 90 minutes or 120 minutes or whatever it is, I'd give them a chance, good chance. I was reading Hope Solo's Guardian column today. She reckoned the way England can beat the USA is to be more quick and direct and prey on their lack of speed in defence.
I've got a premonition of England making it to the final, but someone getting like a Gazza-esque second yellow or a red card to put them out of the final. That's what I'm predicting.
Yeah, the betting markets have it had about 70% chance of the US progressing, which sounds about fair to me. But they've got a chance, England, absolutely.
Come on, England. Right, that'll do for part one. In part two, we'll look back at the other quarterfinals, do the Copa America as well.
I'm Emma John. This is the Guardian's cricket podcast, The Spin, and I'm very excited that England have made it into the World Cup semi-finals after their blistering show against Norway and... Oh, wait, I've picked up Max's script. Let's start again.
It's The Spin!
In the Cricket World Cup, England have gone from tournament favourites to the erratic underdogs we know so well. but they can still make the semi-finals in what will be a vital week for English cricket. Join me, cricket-loving comedians like Miles Jupp, Andy Parsons and Felicity Ward, plus The Guardian's best sports writers, for all the drama of the World Cup and the Ashes series that follows on The Spin.
It's The Spin!
The Spin is supported by NatWest.
Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. The other two quarterfinals then, Netherlands beating Italy 2-0, and the biggest upset, Sweden beating Germany 2-1. Women's football expert Tim Stillman wrote on Twitter, "This was the only game when I couldn't see an upset." And there was an upset, Tim. You know nothing. You're a fraud.
It's true, yeah. I think I called pretty much all of the quarterfinals wrong. I thought that England would beat Norway, but I thought it would be kind of extra time or penalties. But yeah, this one was... Sweden are kind of regarded as quite a defensive team. They've got lots of really kind of top-class defenders and defensive midfielders. But what they did that really pleased me was they saw that even though Germany hadn't conceded before this game, this Germany defence had looked completely rubbish under any kind of pressure. And Sweden have got quite a good quick front four, and they just kept basically... Germany leaves so much space that they basically just kept hitting the ball into space. And they really went for Germany, and I thought that was exactly the right tactic. I just didn't think they'd do it.
Jakobsen and Backstenius looked like a really formidable partnership, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. And Rolfo as well, and she's actually suspended for the semi-final as well. They're all kind of really explosive, really good at running into space, and actually they might have some joy against Netherlands as well in the semis, because Netherlands are kind of similar to Germany. They don't really have a great defence. They were excellent, particularly because they went 1-0 down. As soon as Germany scored, I thought the game was over, to be honest.
That was a lovely finish from Nina McGill, wasn't it? Sort of controlled it with the first touch and volleyed it home. But will Germany feel like they let themselves down here, Lars?
I mean, there wasn't that much, like... I mean, given that they've had a turbulent couple of years, Germany, I don't think there was a sense that this was a tournament they were going to go and win. I mean, they've gone and they've not always played brilliantly, but they've gotten to the quarterfinals. And I don't think that's a catastrophe, really, from their starting point. I wouldn't say so, but I think it's interesting what you're talking about, Sweden being direct. The guy who does the scouting for the Swedish team had a good look at the Netherlands and then very helpfully told the press what he concluded, that he felt you can also, that when it comes to defending in depth, that's where the Dutch struggle a bit as well, and that he thinks there can be space to exploit behind their centre-halves, and they basically the same recipe all over again against Holland. So, I mean, for you Dutch people listening, that's what the Swedes have concluded.
The second goal, though, for Sweden, it did look like Germany should have had a free kick. And the ref put her whistle to her lips for about 5 seconds, to the point where if I'd been playing, I'd have stopped going, that's not just a pensive thought. It's like, I'm going to give a free kick here. And then she didn't. And I thought, I was surprised that they didn't go back for that. Does anyone agree, disagree with me?
I wasn't as surprised by that. I did think that, I think it might have been offside in the end, but there was a penalty shout as well where Hedvig Lindahl kind of punched Alexandra Popp in the head.
Yes.
And I find it a bit weird, actually, in football, how like we've really cracked down on like touching ankles and shins, and kind of rightly so, but kind of anything goes with the face, like an elbow or a fist in the face.
Especially a goalkeeper, right?
Yeah.
And that's an odd one, because that's one of those, that was offside in the end, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was one of those that was allowed to play because VAR is going to clear it up. But if the goalkeeper then punches someone in the head subsequently... You know, I don't know. It's a bit unfortunate when those situations occur.
True, because it's still a foul, right?
Yeah, if you call it violent conduct, then I suppose it is, even if the ball's not in play. But then the offside would have come first.
Sure, but if I'm offside and then Barry comes up to me and just hacks my leg off with a samurai sword, he should still, be a foul.
Yeah, I think that might have, maybe that should have been a pen, actually. But then, I mean, the refs know the rules, better than I do, even so.
I don't know,
I'm sure
if they
got
do.
It right.
I don't, I think you're very good, you're very hot on them.
I'm very good at having the PDF open on my laptop while we're recording the pod.
Well, I mean, the amount of times I get sent a PDF and think, definitely not going to open that because it'll be too long. Because that is a problem with PDFs.
I have the app on the phone.
Jesus.
The IFAB, Laws of the Game app. It's great. Sometimes you just need to, you know.
Is it on the first page of your smartphone, or do you have to slide across?
No. It's on the last one, because I only installed it this tournament.
Oh, excellent.
But if you are a fan of laws being explained, you know, Jackie Oakley on Twitter has been magnificent throughout the season, doing a really good job at just clearing up, posting screenshots and the relevant laws and everything. Like, if there is a refereeing decision that you don't know. Because this is great. There's nothing wrong about not walking around with all these paragraphs in your head. It just means you're a normal person. But, like, if you watch the game in the Women's World Cup and there's been a big call that you've not been sure about, Jackie's been across it magnificently and kept her head, and very, very good.
Judge Jackie. Yeah. I am the law.
Very much the media MVP of the tournament so far in my book.
Netherlands 2, Italy 0. 2 set pieces, 2 good headers from Miedemar and Stephanie van der Gracht. But Italy had the better of the first half, didn't you think, Baz?
Yeah, it was a peculiar game. Quite evenly matched in the first half. Italy had better chances, spurned a couple of good opportunities, and then in the second half were absolutely smithereened by Holland, who blew them away. Holland significantly upped the pace and of in midfield and dominated them totally, and as that began to happen, the Italians lost their discipline and they were getting visibly rattled and visibly narky. Gave away a lot of set pieces in dangerous areas and were punished at two of them.
Oh, they got really kicky, didn't they?
Oh, they were very...
It was lots of fun, wasn't it? They got totally... All those stories about no shithousery, I'm enjoying the fact that they're sort of ebbing away slowly.
Yeah, yeah. So I kind of know Danielle van der Donk quite well, plays for Arsenal all tournament. I've kind of been wondering what's wrong with her, because when you watch Danielle van der Donk, she always gets in at least one fight per game. But during this World Cup, she's been immaculately behaved. But she began to get a little bit narky and upset. And I thought, ah, there's the DVD I know. They've finally got through to her.
And even the referee, you could see, was getting narky. She was getting very annoyed with the Italians. I think she booked maybe three of them. Her name actually, in just a nod to nominative determinism, she's a Uruguayan lady called Claudia Umparez.
Mm. Yeah, no, it's very nice. Good. And she's a lawyer as well.
I believe so, yes. So a stickler for law and order. And she's married to, or in a relationship with, a referee as well.
I wondered in this game if it once again, fitness was the key and tiredness. I just thought Italy looked shattered.
A little bit. Their front three has been their big strength this tournament, and it was broken up. They lost their striker Girelli, who's had a brilliant tournament, and that had an effect. Barbara Bonansea went off early in the second half. I mean, Netherlands have so much more individual quality than Italy, and Italy had a really, really good tournament up to this point. But there's always this kind of suspicion with the Dutch manager Serena Weigman that Netherlands don't really have a plan, that she does just throw out all these really good players and just hope that they do something. And she kind of famously never, ever, ever changes the starting lineup under any circumstances. And I wonder if she'll have to revisit that. But in the second half, to be fair, they really kicked it up and Italy just couldn't live with them.
I hope she's the manager in 50 years and she's still being the same team of 70-year-olds.
They're having a slightly odd tournament, like the Dutch, because like they're in the semi-finals now. But as you say, they rarely look like they have a coherent plan. They don't look convincing at the back, but they're in the semi-finals, and they have these great players who can win the game.
But is a Dutch team without a plan better than a Swedish team with a plan?
You'd say so, probably, yeah. But
just about. But yeah. I think that would be a really, really interesting game for that exact reason, actually. And one of the quite interesting things about the final four is there are probably questions over all of the coaches except for Peter Gerhardsen with Sweden. I think he's the only one that doesn't really have question marks, that's doing a demonstratively good job over quite a long period of time.
And who said magnificently that they're going all the way. There's not a single mitochondria in us that's content.
Wow, that is...
Which I think, breaking it down to the cellular level, is top management. I mean, that's how they're...
Just finally on the women's...
Do you know what the mitochondria do, Max?
Do they make protein?
No.
I mean, you need to know the answer, Mr.
Quizmaster. I looked it up.
Okay, what do they do?
It said that they're the parts of the cells that turn sugars, fats, and proteins that we eat into forms of chemical energy that the body can use to carry on living.
Yeah, he had a quote earlier in the tournament as well. It's something to do with carbohydrates. But
Exploding their carbohydrates or something slightly odd like
that. Sounded quite unpleasant. Maybe
he's a nutritionist in his spare time or just a school teacher who does science class. Because that was the last time I heard about the mitochondria that was in school.
I'm looking forward to, the return of the Premier League. I want some footballing dinosaurs to get cellular. I want cellular Pardew. That's what I want.
But I really want Sweden to go through now to see what he brings before the final now, because he's been talking about exploding the carbohydrates or whatever it was, and now also
presumably he'll have to.
What's going on with the mitochondria? I mean, what is next?
He'll have to go atomic, won't he? Finally, on the women's game, the full fixtures or the opening fixtures for the WSL, which starts in September, have just been announced. Manchester Derby on the opening day and Chelsea v Spurs. Are they exciting, or am I sort of being a naive Premier League fan and looking at those fixtures?
I mean, they are hugely exciting, and there's a reason they've only released the first games of the season today, and they're going to release the others next week. And obviously, for good reason, that's been designed that way, so that you have a London derby and a Manchester derby. That didn't randomly come out of the fixture computer.
So they use a different fixture computer to the other fixture computer.
Clearly. But and obviously doing this while the World Cup's going on, while the Lionesses are still there, and it's I think the first fixture of the season is during international weekend for the men's as well, so it's all kind of part of the marketing.
Wow, seems clever, right? Copa America time, great fun in the quarterfinals. Three goalless draws with penalty shootouts at 90 minutes. Brazil beating Paraguay, Chile, Colombia, Peru beating Uruguay on penalties. Luis Suarez missed the decisive pen, which was the first one in that game. He was inconsolable afterwards. Barry, you felt sorry for Luis Suarez, didn't you?
No, not really. I don't think. Poor Lewis's misery seems to have brightened up the weekend for a lot of people.
He was really sad about it.
He was. He looked heartbroken, just sobbing uncontrollably. And, karma's a bitch, I suppose. But I didn't see the game. I've only seen the footage of him crying. But it appears to have been the highlight.
Would you say that, Tim?
I don't know, actually. So Uruguay had three goals disallowed by VAR. And I think it was the last one, Edinson Cavani. I really, really advise looking this clip out, because he scores, he does a knee slide to the corner flag, and then he eventually realises that the goal's been ruled out by VAR, and his transition from ecstasy to rueful disappointment is absolutely brilliant, because he's on his knees and he looks happy, and then all of a sudden he just kind of sinks and looks absolutely bereft, and it's brilliant.
I think he does it quite well.
Yeah,
because he sort of stays on his knees. It's like if you trip over in the street, you should just stay down for a bit, acknowledge that you've tripped over in the street, acknowledge anyone that's seen it. There was no way he could say, "I didn't knee slide there." He did knee slide. I'm full of praise for Cavani.
Yeah, he styles it out brilliantly, and actually it makes you realise that kind of being on your knees can be simultaneously quite an ecstatic pose and at the same time quite a sad one, and he handles that transition perfectly.
I'm against knee slides.
You can injure yourself, can't
you? Well, if I was a manager, I would be A, pleased my player has scored, and then really worried he was going to do himself a mischief. See also backflips.
Yes. Would you, I mean, because obviously when managers ban ketchup, there's a big hoo-ha. Would you be that kind of, ban a lot of things?
No, I wouldn't. No. I mean, everyone thinks they could manage a football team. I know I would be absolutely hopeless.
You might have covered this on the last one.
I couldn't train mice to eat cheese.
I caught a mouse the other day.
What?
Yeah. There's been a mouse in our house.
Like alive. Are you trying to convert him?
there's been a mouse and he hasn't gone in the humane traps. So I sat for an hour.
Humane traps.
I sat for an hour with a colander tied with some string through the handle of the fridge. And I had put some Alpen, sugarless Alpen, on the floor. And eventually he came out, took a little bit, ran away. Then he stayed there for a bit, let go of the string. Colander went down, caught the mouse, put a big piece of cardboard underneath, taped it all up, went out and undid it near someone else's house.
That's almost like a literal game of mousetrap. Did you have a ball going down and shoot?
Yeah, exactly. And then my wife was dressed up as a deep sea diver and jumped into a... It was great fun. You made a point the other day, Tim, that games going to penalty shootouts after 90 minutes, we've all kind of watched that and think, oh, that's brilliant, because extra time is... We all want to go home and we're bored. But actually, this just encourages bus parking of the highest order, right?
Yeah, it does. And this was particularly apparent in the Brazil-Paraguay game. But it actually became quite fun because, you know, Paraguay were, as you'd expect, two banks of four, try and catch them on the counter-attack. And then they had a red card about 4 or 5 minutes into the second half. Actually, it was originally given as a penalty. VAR reviewed it, saw that the foul happened outside the area and so sent the Paraguayan defender off. And at that point, it was like someone had pressed a massive panic button, because Brazil were thinking, right, we don't want penalties. And Paraguay were thinking, right, our only chance is penalties. And there's a bit of history here as well, because Paraguay have knocked Brazil out in 2011 and 2015. They knocked Brazil out on penalties. And again, I'm going to advise people to go down a YouTube wormhole, look up the penalty shootout from 2011 between Brazil and Paraguay. It finished 2-0 after 8 penalties
each.
There was like an exploding penalty spot.
Would Chilavert have been playing?
No. But yeah, there was like an exploding penalty spot situation. And Andre Santos in particular, his goes so high that honestly, I think that another 3 goals on top of the goal, it wouldn't have gone in.
If I can recommend a YouTube wormhole, which probably doesn't even exist, in Home and Away, Damo took a penalty. And there's a whole story, a sort of football story that curled so much it ended up on the halfway line. It was one of the greatest bits of sport in drama you'll ever see. Alexis Sanchez scored the penalty, putting Chile through. He's having a great time out there, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. And Chile are quite interesting, actually. They've come in under the radar on this one because they've kind of had their golden generation and they've won the last two, and that wasn't entirely unexpected. But now they've got nothing coming through. The team is exactly the same as the one they had 3-4 years ago. They didn't qualify for the World Cup, so no one expected anything from them. But they've actually kind of made a couple of tweaks to the team because they're all too old to play this Bielsa high press anymore. And so they've actually put a couple of tall defenders in so that they don't have to play so high up. And I think they've got a good chance of winning the Copa America again, actually. They should get past Peru. And then in the final against Brazil or Argentina, I think they'd have a chance.
Yeah, Argentina rudely scored some goals during the game. It would have been great to have 4 goalless draws, wouldn't it? Did they deserve it?
I mean, just about. I mean, Argentina were as good as Argentina ever get, which was okay. Venezuela put a little bit of pressure on at the beginning of the second half, but conceded a goal against the run of play. The issue for Argentina, they've kind of stumbled on a front three that works with Messi, Aguero and Martinez, but now they're playing slightly better opposition in Brazil. There's a question mark over whether they can continue to play those three players, because it takes something away from midfield. And, you know, if you're looking at players tracking back, Messi's not going to do that. Martinez probably isn't going to do that. So by default, it would have to be Aguero. And you lose a lot of Aguero if you do that. So there's a big question mark for them in the semi-final.
Argentina's Rodrigo De Paul was tackled by a pigeon, which is nice, isn't it? I mean, I think that's giving the pigeon perhaps more credit.
Explain?
Well,
yeah. Was he tackled by the pigeon or did he run into the pigeon?
Essentially, a pigeon was run over by a ball. Is that a better description?
Bird strike, isn't it? I was about to say, like, when birds get sucked into airline engines, we call it a bird strike, which I feel is very harsh on the bird.
I mean, the pigeon definitely took ball and man.
Yeah. Mm.
Well. Yeah, it was a decent challenge. But the difficulty for the pigeon is that it's not really tall enough. So when you get tackled by the pigeon, it's the whole of the pigeon that disappears under the ball. What you needed was, you know, would you rather fight a footballer-sized pigeon or 100 pigeon-sized footballers, et cetera, et cetera. A message from Alejandro on Jimenez asking Falcao why Venezuela, Colombia and Ecuador share the same flag colour. He says, because we started as a single country and then we split, he said. Winky face emoji, which is nice. But Tim emailed on the same subject to say, I was catching up on the recent pods, heard the story you told about Falcao and Jimenez, and it was thoroughly enjoyable, but a little too good to be true. I had a search and believe you may have been onioned. It appears on many pages in English, but very few in Spanish, and one of those is on a page that seems to be a Uruguayan version of The Onion. There's no published date to confirm. I suspect that this website published the joke story, which was copied by Goal.com in Spanish. From there, it made its way to the English-speaking interweb world, which I, you know...
That's very disappointing.
It is disappointing,
true.
Yeah. He said, then again, I could be wrong. Jimenez has made a career by being a genius distractor. So I am sticking with it. Lars?
I mean, it reminds me of the story Berta Hangeland tells of playing against Adebayor, and Adebayor sort of like chatting to him during the game. But he was asking for like restaurant recommendations and stuff. And I think that was just Adebayor. He was just hungry, I think. Don't think there was part of some sort of master plan.
Anyway, that'll do for part two. And part three, we'll begin with the African Cup of Nations. We'll talk to Nick Ames, who's out in Egypt. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's start talking about the African Cup of Nations with Nick Ames, who's out there for the Guardian. Nick, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you, Max. How are you?
Yeah, marvellous. Where do we find you?
Yeah. I'm in a taxi, actually, in Alexandria. I'm just off to an interview a football player, actually. But I've been to Alexandria a couple of times now in the last week or two. It's like a... I'd say it's like an Agatha Christie novel on acid, really, which is not something I'd recommend trying at home, by the way. It's a fantastic place with sort of really sort of grubby 1920s and 30s architecture and a very sort of raffish, disreputable sort of air to it. So I completely recommend.
And David Suchet just wandering around.
Yes.
Who are you interviewing?
Kenneth Omoruo, the eternal Chelsea loanee / Nigeria, said that should be in a newspaper called The Guardian near you this weekend.
Will you ask him about the loanees, if they have like a big WhatsApp group, and also if they do, who's the most fun in it?
It's the most famous WhatsApp group in the world, that, isn't it? I think every single Chelsea loanee who gets interviewed refers to it religiously. So yes, I will be asking him about that.
Presumably, he'll be a bit sad because Madagascar beat Nigeria.
Yeah, fantastic result. I think Omoruo actually was rested for that game. I mean, on paper, that is the most sort of seismic, really, of Cup of Nations shocks. I mean, Madagascar first timers. No one really knows a lot about them or knew a lot about them until the last week or so. Nigeria did rest quite a few players, Kenneth Omoruo included. I think there was one eye, obviously, on the second round to which they'd already qualified. But there was also, I think, a bit of complacency, to be honest, if you watch their performance, which was sluggish and one-paced. They got done for the first goal by dallying around on the edge of their own box and being pressed, and Madagascar scored. Then a bit of a deflection, I think it was, for the second. But Madagascar, a great breath of fresh air here, actually. They've got a few sort of old stages from the French leagues who have been conscripted into service, but a lot of quite fresh and very long, by the way, names. But play some good attacking football, and I wouldn't rule them out getting to the quarterfinals.
A big story of the weekend came from Egypt, and Amir Wada, suspended from the squad for the tournament, was allowed to rejoin the squad after the players, particularly Mo Salah, intervened. And this is about alleged sexual harassment online. How's it played out in Egypt?
Yeah, it's caused massive ructions here, actually. Particularly the intervention of Salah, which was ill-judged at best, I think. What happened was that Wada was suspended before the match against DR Congo last week. That game was played, Egypt won, and you might have thought that the players would wait for some sort of inquiry to play out before giving their opinion. But at that game, Ahmed El Mohammadi, who scored the second goal, held up his fingers in a number 22, which is Wada's squad number, in a sort of defiant, supportive pose. Then Salah tweeted later that, while no means no, people are entitled to a second chance. And after that, things kind of blew up a bit. And it transpires that some very heavy player power, with Salah very influential, I think, was exerted on the Egyptian Football Association. There were meetings long into the night after that DR Congo game. I know that, between the players and the president of the association and other people. And it transpired that WADA was made to miss last night's game, which they won against Uganda 2-0, but it will be allowed back in the fold for the knockout stages. And there's been all these photos coming out of WADA training with the squad smiling and stuff like that. And I just think it's a really bad look. And I think that whoever advised Salah to make that tweet was ill-advised too. I mean, while people do deserve second chances, yes, the fact is it's a very serious set of allegations. And there's no getting away from that, really. And Salah, in trying to build bridges, I think, and trying to be statesmanlike to Egypt and trying to keep together a squad in a country that is so desperate to win this tournament, has made a massive misstep. I mean, the online hashtags of, like, Salah supports sexual harassment and stuff like that told you a lot about what a lot of local people thought of the situation. Mm.
And hasn't Salah been quite vocal about women's rights previously?
He has indeed. And I would not say for one minute that Salah was being malicious or ill-meant in any statement that he made. I just think it's one of those situations where a footballer who maybe isn't wonderfully hasn't had that big an education and is also deeply, deeply religious and has very, very serious and deep ideas of forgiveness, I think, feels that he has to be statesmanlike and say something. And sometimes it's better just to say nothing. And instead, he's totally put his foot in it, really. At the stadium last night, to be fair, he scored a very good free kick. There's no problem with his on-pitch performance. And there wasn't really much negative reaction in there. It's mainly been playing out online and in people on the street to whom I've spoken. If there is one positive to all this, I think it may have intensified the debate in Egypt and awareness around sexual harassment, which is a common problem here in society. I don't think it's unfair to say that. And I think if one bit of good comes out of all this, it has, you know, focused the debate a bit.
On the pitch, Morocco looking the strongest, would you say?
Yeah, I think so. They're playing some fantastic football. I watched them beat Ivory Coast 1-0 in a supposed clash of the heavyweights a few nights ago. And it was 1-0 going on 5-0. I mean, their coach has got a great record of winning in this tournament, of course, but they've got some fantastic, you know, technical attacking players, like we saw in the World Cup, actually, when they played some great stuff against Spain, for example, but couldn't quite finish teams off. I would say that the North African teams have been the most impressive so far. You could put that down maybe to the climate. It's incredibly hot here, as I think it's been well publicised, like 35, 36, even 38 degrees at some matches. They're quite used to it. I also think maybe that the North African teams do have better playmakers, technical players. You've got players like Mahrez on Algeria. You've got Salah, who is basically winning games almost on his own at the moment for Egypt. You've got Ziyech, people like this. And I'd say the North African teams have probably looked the strongest so far.
Nick, we touched on it last week, but like a first-hand account of how... Between you and the Guardians, Ed Ahrens kitted out the Burundi team, who have now exited the tournament.
Yeah, no, they sadly came back with a nil point and nil goals, which I think tells you how successful those boots were. it was the boots, not the kit. That was a small exaggeration, which I heard propagated at one stage. I was working with the Burundi team for a piece I was doing for about 4 days in their training camp in Doha earlier this month. And at the end of the training camp, they took me up for a beer, and I thought, they definitely want something, don't they? And they did. They wanted their boots transported from Milton Keynes, where they were waiting in a warehouse, don't ask me why, to Egypt. So I said yes and then thought nothing else of it, and had a phone call just before I left for Cairo, actually, saying, can you still take them? And I was like, yes, but I'm about to leave for Cairo. So feeling a bit guilty and in a bit of a panic, I dropped Ed a message, who was staying with me in my Airbnb and coming out a day later. And Ed, being a very kind soul, accepted this gargantuan hospital pass I'd given him. And delivery the next morning of these two enormous sacks of boots that he or someone else might have told you already looked not very much like boots at all. As he then discovered when he got to customs and was asked for £6,000. and made to wait for 3 hours in the middle of the night. all was basically well that ended well. I'll skip over a few other details of the sort of slightly confusing situation I had to try and come and meet him after that. But Burundi got their boots, ultimately, and they were too late for the first game, but they got them for the second and third games, and they were not shooting boots.
But they were boots all the same. It's a good anecdote to have, isn't it? Thanks for coming on. And we will speak to you again, no doubt.
Cheers. Take care.
Nick Ames there in a taxi in Alexandria to the Gold Cup. Haiti 3, Canada 2. Canada were 2-0 up. The second set up by Scott Arfield, who I think I knew at the back of my mind was Canadian, but had basically forgotten.
I had no idea. Come as a complete shock.
And then Haiti scored three. Poor defending, a penalty, and another one. Canada scored late on, disallowed for offside. No VAR in the Gold Cup. It looked pretty tight. So well done to Haiti. Mexico beat Costa Rica on penalties. Jamaica beat Panama 1-0. And the USA beat Curaçao 1-0. Why are you laughing, Lars?
No, not at all.
Are you thinking it's a blue alcoholic drink? Is that you?
I was just thinking that's not a hugely impressive result by the
Americans.
No,
but you just got to win. What's in front of you? You got to beat what's in front of you, Lars. They're still in it,
and they did do that.
Norway still in the Women's World Cup.
Sorry,
they're not, are they?
No, they didn't play Curaçao either.
Well, no, that is true. Anyway, so there you go. That's the
I'm
gold
just trying
cup.
To find a country to insult where we can't possibly have any listeners.
We may well have one listener in Curaçao. If you're in Curaçao, let us know. We'll come over and do a live show.
I'm sure there's some sort of great story there that I've trampled all over. I do apologize, but you know.
No, that's okay, Lars. You're allowed to make these knee-jerk, judgmental reactions. That's totally fine. The European Under-21s finished, the tournament finished Spain 2, Germany 1. The final in Italy, although England are the best team in the tournament, despite the two teams that beat them lost in the semi-finals to Spain and Germany. Newcastle United, Rafa's done a statement today, everyone. It became increasingly clear to me that those at the top of the club did not share the same vision. I wanted to stay, but I didn't just want to sign an extended contract. I wanted to be part of a project. I'm very sad about that, but I do not regret for one moment my decision to come to Tyneside. I'm very proud about what we achieved together. Come on, Toons. Baz, you wrote a piece about it all today, didn't you?
Yeah, following up on what I said on Thursday, that I think it's time Newcastle fans voted with their feet and just stopped going to games. There's I don't know if it's a guy or a few guys and gals on Twitter. There's a website, ashleyout.com, and they have called on Newcastle fans to boycott St. James's Park and businesses associated with it and with Ashley. And I can't see it happening, to be honest, because football fans tend never to be, you know, even if they have the same common goal, they can never agree on how to achieve it. And these things can end up actually driving wedges between various factions. So, but it would be interesting, you know, if Arsenal rocked up to Newcastle on the first day of the season and there was no one there to watch the game.
I think I've got a kind of theory here that I think Rafa Benitez is going to struggle to find another job that suits him as much as Newcastle. A lot of the focus, I think, understandably, has been on Newcastle losing Benitez. But what does Benitez like? He likes to have a bit of tension with an owner. Newcastle is the perfect place for that. He likes the adoration of the fans. He gets that. Everyone's on his side against Ashley. And he's got a team there that kind of accepts his defensive style of football. I'm not sure that style really works at the top level anymore. I think the reason he hung on so long is because he knows that this job was kind of perfect for him in a way.
Where else could he go? Where could he go where it's tense with a bad owner? Where he'd be completely loved. I mean, there must
Charlton.
Be...
Charlton.
Speaking of protests, apparently there's going to be a protest at the shirt launch of Arsenal, Tim. I heard this, but I looked around. I couldn't see any
what are they
information.
Protesting?
I'm not sure that Arsenal haven't signed anyone or something like that.
Yeah, quite a lot. I don't think that was ever really that serious. I think that was one or two people being quite loud on Twitter, okay. But I wouldn't be surprised if you saw something maybe a little bit more sustained and serious than that at the beginning of next season, against the ownership in particular.
Okay, and then you could get Rafa in.
Yeah, absolutely. Why not?
Derby says... Arsenal
just they don't have a lot of money. They just don't. So you can't sign that many players then. I mean, they've spent quite a lot of money and can... on some old players, and they've committed themselves to paying some pretty big wages, and they're out of the Champions League, right? They don't have that much money.
We were saying before the pod, Tim, are you surprised that Mesut Ozil was in that kit launch video, which is good?
No, I wasn't, because he's got a personal boot deal with Adidas. I think he was always going to be front and centre of that, and as much as Arsenal would probably like to lose him, I don't think it's very likely.
Wilfried Zaha, do you think he'll end up there? I mean... they don't. If they don't have a lot of money, and Crystal Palace want a lot of money.
Yeah, and they're obviously they have no need to sell really. And Zaha's on pretty decent money at Palace, so yeah, I don't see that happening really.
A question.
Sorry, just briefly going back to Newcastle.
Yeah.
Apparently Neil Redfern is going to be taking charge of pre-season training while they dawdle, hum and haw over replacing Benitez, Giovanni Bronckhorst, and Patrick Vieira were two of the names being mentioned.
And Arteta's mentioned as well.
I couldn't see Arteta taking that job.
Neil Redfern was, I think his last management job was Liverpool Women, where he survived for one game because he was so annoyed with, shall we say, the ownership and the way things were run. So let's see how he gets on with Newcastle.
Luke says, Philip Koku, possibly to Derby. Masterstroke or car crash waiting to happen? Koku at Derby?
It's a bit of an odd one. Mm. He did really well with PSV and not so well at Fenerbahce. So, I don't know, the Turkish league, it's not one of those places where for foreigners to come in, some of them have a terrible time. It doesn't necessarily mean they're bad managers. I think his football at PSV, if I remember correctly, was not. He's not like an all-out attack kind of guy. Like they were solidly, quite solid defensively. I think he was there when they had Depay and Wijnaldum and stuff like that going forward. Him at Derby, it's a bit of a left field one. It'd be interesting, absolutely.
This is more for people in the room than people listening to the pod. But why does it suddenly smell incredibly of hard-boiled eggs?
Not guilty.
Well, I mean, I don't. No one,
not me.
Can you smell it?
I can smell
a little bit
something.
Yeah, I mean, it's extraordinary.
Unpleasant. Or something. It's like.
It's like someone has just opened the biggest egg sandwich on the tube. It's totally you know, look, if the rest of the pod meanders a bit, that's why. In mindless transfer news, well, Manchester United have signed Aaron Wan-Bissaka. We all thought it would happen, 50 million. He made his first in debut for Palace last year, agreed a 5-year deal. He'll earn up to 80 grand a week. Ed Woodward told staff in an internal email that the club plans to add more exciting players this summer following the completion of that deal. Other possible players, Bruno Fernandes from Sporting Lisbon. He is very good. Wissam Ben Yedder from Sevilla, if they sell Lukaku to Inter. And my favourite, John McGinn from Villa for 50 million. How many of those, Lars, are going to be in the red of Manchester United in August?
I'm worried about this egg smell.
Well, don't worry about it. You can't look that up online.
Rotten.
Are you Shazamming the smell?
Because if we're getting gas, like, I feel like that's something we should know.
I don't think we are we?
If you detect a rotten egg smell in your neighbourhood or around your home, it's likely that you're in the presence of hydrogen sulfide.
Oh, dear.
That's probably not the case at Guardian headquarters.
Well, you never know.
It comes from sewage treatment plants.
Okay.
Maybe someone's just having a sandwich.
Well, anyway, I'll point you to the question.
Wan-Bissaka's pretty good. I don't know what we're talking about.
Wan-Bissaka, Bruno Fernandes, Ben Yedder, John McGinn.
The John McGinn thing is really funny.
50 million.
Yes, I think Aston Villa would take that.
It was only the second strangest rumour doing the rounds this morning.
Dwight McNeil
to Juventus.
What?
Burnley midfielder Dwight McNeil to Juventus.
He's a good player, right?
He is a good player, but it was one of those ones where you just go, what?
I think Bruno Fernandes, who I watched in the Nations League, is a tremendous player, actually.
And, yeah, he's very good. I wonder about the Wan-Bissaka thing. I don't know if you've covered this, but it is an interesting thing because he looked very good for Palace. But if you look at his numbers, and he's primarily good at defending, like he wins a lot of tackles and this sort of thing. But as a fullback at Man United, you need to do quite a lot more going forward than what he's been doing. there, now that could be something to do with the demands placed on him by Roy Hodgson's system and his way of playing. We don't know yet, but if you look at his like crossing statistics, he doesn't get a lot of crosses into the box. I think he had 3 assists last season or something. He's going to have to add some attacking stuff to his game at United, which I'm sure he can, but it's a bit of a gamble on a player who's played one season where he's looked very good and hasn't done a lot of the things he'll have to do at Man United.
Chelsea have warned Atletico that they'll cancel the loan of Alvaro Morata if they don't make his move permanent. Higuain's gone, so I guess there could be a space for Morata back there, but they've got Tammy Abraham and Olivier Giroud. Derby have excused Lampard from pre-season training, so they can tie up that deal, so that will all happen probably. Spurs are on the verge of signing 2 footballers. Extraordinary. Ndombele, who we talked about, and Jack Clarke. Apparently Manchester United might come in for Ndombele, but Ndombele wants to go to Tottenham, apparently. And Jack Clarke, who they will loan back to Leeds after signing him. And apparently Daniel Levy has called Real Madrid about Christian Eriksen. Do you reckon they have? Do you reckon he has?
What, it's because he wants to sell or because he wants them to naff off?
He wants to sell him.
Yeah, you'd think so with the contract situation. Like, they don't want him to leave for free. Mm. So it's very much in their interest to get a transfer fee from this summer.
I sort of how that call works. You know, do you arrange it by email? Do you just ring up? Yeah. Florentino Perez straight away and just go, have you ever heard of Christian Eriksen?
Quite good. He's a good lad, yeah. You know.
Nice guy. I'm just saying.
Yeah, pretty just, low maintenance kind of guy.
Yeah.
Or do they do it all by fax still?
I reckon it's WhatsApp. I reckon. Liverpool bringing back Coutinho, Barry. That's surely nonsense.
Probably. I mean, as far as I can tell, there's no concrete evidence to suggest Liverpool want him, just that they would be open to the possibility because he made some disparaging remarks about Manchester United.
Sounds good enough to me. Yeah.
Transfer rumours are the best.
Well, you know, they're good enough for the mindless transfer gossip section that we are currently in. We'll finish it.
It always made a lot of sense for me if Barcelona are going to try to get Neymar in, if they could use Coutinho as a make weight there, because you can see him fitting in at PSG. You can make the numbers add up a bit more. Yeah.
Some good news from Portugal, away from mindless transfer nonsense. Iker Casillas has today resumed training with Porto, 2 months to the day since his heart attack, so that is excellent news. Neil says, hey Max, feel like a couple of minutes in the next pod should be dedicated to Wayne Rooney's performances in MLS this season. So many footballers come here for one last payday, but Wayne has shown again what a player he is, an inspiration to any young player out there. He scored the winner for DC United against Orlando Magic, booting it a long way, which he's done quite a few times, hasn't
he? That's the third time he scored from inside his own half. That was a beaut.
It was a good one.
Beauty.
His best is the one for Everton, because the ball is coming towards him. The way he strikes that is one of the purest strikes of a football I think you'll ever see.
I think this one loses points just because it bounces just before it goes into the net, and I think it always loses something when it does that.
Did it?
Yeah. I think it bounced after it went over the line, but not before it hit the net.
Right.
Did anyone see Big John Parkin's Twitter? Did anyone see this? He's tweets, after a bit of help, does anyone know where I need to go to sign on in Barnsley? He's tweeted a picture of an email saying, good afternoon, please find your P45 attached, from the from Moifa, the payroll clerk at York City. But in a bit like the Notts County camera roll, if you remember, where the Notts County chairman on his camera roll had a picture of his erect penis. Do you remember that story?
Yeah.
John Parkin, in his camera roll, lots of holiday snaps, and then a picture of what he'd done in the toilet.
What?
Basically, yeah, he'd taken a photo. And so lots of people were like, hey, John, have you noticed there's a poo? You tweeted a picture of your own poo. And he just replied, the lads from the podcast he does asked how your holiday's going, and I said, brilliant, apart from the constipation that we can all see subsided quite dramatically. Phew. Thank you very much, John Parkin. Lewis says, what's Barry's review of Glastonbury?
I didn't see a huge amount of it, to be honest. I saw Stormzy, thought it was great. Kylie, great.
Janet Jackson forgot to have a microphone on.
Not great. I've recorded quite a lot of it and will watch it at my leisure in the coming days.
An email from Ian says, some months ago you mentioned the arrival of the fledgling Canadian Premier League, did we? I've completely forgotten that. I attended a game last night. I was delighted to discover that the Halifax Wanderers have a player whose name is Elton John. Oh, that's good. If the world has to know nothing else about the Canadian Premier League, it must know this.
My sister lives in Halifax.
Oh, really?
So that must be her local team.
It must be. Get her along.
I suspect she probably hasn't been to see them yet, but I'll mention it to her.
Could you send, I presume, what's her name? Barryina. Is it Barryina? Is there a female version of Barry? What? What's the name? What would be the female?
Why would she?
Well, I don't know. I'm just wondering. What, if you were a girl, if Barry had a daughter and was sort of Nigel Lawson obsessed, what would he call his daughter?
Barbara?
Is that okay? Okay.
I don't know.
Barbara Glendening. Can you send her there to send back a scouting report on Elton John?
I will. I'll ask her. Okay. I very much doubt she'd be in the slightest bit interested. But
neither is anyone else.
Nope.
George says, my friend has just had a son, Benjamin Arlo McEwen. He said he can't wait to hear an Irishman pronounce the name with gravitas. I told him I knew the man to ask. Will you please welcome Ben to the world on the next Football Weekly pod? Benjamin Arlo McEwen, please, Barry. If you could welcome him in your own inimitable style.
Well, I would like to welcome Benjamin Arlo McEwen into the world and wish him a very long life and plenty of happiness.
Thank you, Barry.
You're welcome.
And thanks for coming today.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Lars.
Thanks, Max.
Thanks, Tim.
Pleasure.
Back on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.